Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week we hear from Boonville native and rising country music artist Taylor Austin Dye. She has a new album out, is on tour, and is about to take the stage at the hallowed Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. And I have a fun conversation with Blair Thomas Hess and Cameron Ludwig. They're the co-authors of Kentucky Y'all, a celebration of the people and culture of the Bluegrass State. First, some advice on how to navigate your way through a confusing news media landscape. It's from one who's taken up that challenge and figured out a way to fully inform yourself on any given issue or event so that you can make well-considered decisions. And in a taping before the November 5th election, he was the guest of Carolyn DuPont for her Eastern Standard series, You're Polarized, I'm Polarized, The Way to a Shared American Future.
Today, our guest is Isaac Saul, founder of Tangle News, an online nonpartisan newsletter. Its motto is At War with Partisan News. We're talking with Isaac today as a way of considering the role of media in aggravating political polarization and what we as citizens can do to counteract these trends. Welcome, Isaac.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Tell us briefly about how and why you came to start Tangle News. And in particular, I'm curious about what the need was that you saw and how you were trying to fill it.
Yeah, so I like to say there's kind of two genesis stories for me. The first is just that I grew up in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is a politically divided bellwether county in a bellwether state that, you know, typically determines the presidential election winner every year. So I just grew up around people whom I loved and cared about that had really strong disagreements politically, which I think was sort of good for my brain. And the second was just as a news consumer, as somebody, you know, I'm a politics journalist by trade, but, you know, a story would come out about a policy issue, like, say, Trump's border wall or something really controversial. And in order to get a really holistic understanding of the pros and cons of that policy, I would have to go read the New York Times and then go read the Wall Street Journal and then watch CNN and then go watch Fox News and then listen to some conservative podcasts and then go on YouTube and watch a couple more liberal YouTube videos. And then, you know, 12 hours later, consuming all this content, I would feel like, oh, okay, now I finally have the best arguments that both sides have about why this policy is good or bad, which is not how it should work. I should be able to get that in 10 minutes. And so the concept for Tangle was sort of born out of that, which was I want to put these really strong arguments and these really diverse opinions all in the same place, all under one tent. So one person could spend 10, 15 minutes on one issue and leave feeling like they really understand it.
Yeah, and I'll just say that I often feel that way after reading an issue of Tangle News, and I often come away going, wow, I didn't know as much as I think I did about that. And I like that it makes me feel that way. So some people blame the media for the country's polarization. And I'm just curious, is that blame well placed? You know, to what extent do you think the media deserves this blame?
I love that question. It's something I think about a lot. I mean, I'll say two things. One is, of course, I think that the media has culpability in the polarization that we're witnessing because there are really bad incentives all across the media. I mean, most organizations live and die by advertising revenue. Subscriptions are becoming a lot more popular, which generally I think is a good thing. But, you know, if you're CNN or you're the Washington Post or any mainstream media outlet, you need traffic and you need ratings. And the best way to get those is to publish stuff that's maybe a little bit sensational or a little bit inflammatory or catches people's eyes. And so that motivation, I think, drives a lot of the more partisan bias that we see in the media. Of course, people who work at different media organizations tend to have really similar ideological feelings about the country, which is also an issue. Not a lot of politically and ideologically diverse newsrooms out there anymore, which is a real shame. But I also think the consumers play a big role, and I think that we have a big responsibility. And, you know, the thing I like to tell people is all the time, my friends come up to me because they know I'm a politics reporter and they say, I'm so tired of hearing about Trump, or I'm so tired of hearing about Biden's age. Like, would you guys just shut up and stop, like, tell your friends who work at the New York Times to stop talking about it. And, you know, my answer is typically, okay, you go to newyorktimes.com, like literally you go to the website, you go to foxnews.com, whatever it is. And there is two articles on the homepage. And one of them is about, you know, Biden having some memory slip during a meeting. And the other one is about a new healthcare policy that's going to save Americans $500 a month. Which of those articles do you click on? And most people click on the memory one. And, you know, people click on the bus crash. That's the, if it bleeds, it leads. I mean, it's a cliche because it's true. And so, you know, I tell people, think of every click you make and every 20 seconds you spend on a television show as giving that company a dollar. You're telling them that you want more of this, you support this, and they act on that signal. So I think consumers play a big role too, and we can change our behaviors to show media organizations that we want something different.
So I hear you saying you think it's a shared blame. So we can't say it's all the media, and we, a lot of it's us, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And it's really how I feel. I mean, I see how it happens and the way it proliferates. Yeah. It's upsetting that people don't recognize it. I mean, I don't think on both sides, you know, I don't think a lot of journalists and media executives really take responsibility for their role in it. I don't think a lot of consumers do either.
Yeah. So since we're talking on the role of the citizen consumer of news, how can we recognize the features of good journalism, and how can we recognize bias in bad journalism? Because I think very often, especially the more we consume only news from one perspective, the less we can recognize the bias, because after a while it becomes a shared bias, or it begins as a shared bias. So how can we be more discerning? What do we need to know that we should be looking for in news?
One of the tips that I like to tell people is, if you're reading an entire news article, especially about an issue that's maybe controversial, you know, immigration or something to do with trans rights, or, you know, one of these hot button issues that we hear Americans talking about a lot these days, if you're not reading any quotes or any information or any framing of the issue that really challenges you, that makes you uncomfortable, that maybe makes you mad, then you're probably not reading an article that is sharing a wide breadth of opinions and giving you kind of a holistic look at it. So, you know, I tell people that all the time, that if you're opening a news story and you read it from top to bottom and nothing in there makes you think or is new information or challenges you or maybe upsets you or annoys you, then it's really unlikely you're being presented with, you know, opinions and diverse views about this issue. And that's what news stories should do. I mean, even the straight news teams, they should be interviewing a diverse group of people to get a wide variety of opinions to present their readers. They should be, you know, trying to offer different framings for the story. They should offer competing statistics that back up, you know, whatever arguments are out there. That's the job of journalists, in my opinion. And so I think when you don't get that, that's really the best signal. And it's probably the easiest way to sort of realize that you might be operating in some kind of ideological bubble. Mm.
That's really great advice. And I want to tell you, you do make me mad about once a week, but I love you for it. Okay, so one of the things that I appreciate about you is the way that you're a strong advocate for the First Amendment, freedom of the press, freedom of speech. And I've heard you say things like, you know, government should be nowhere near journalism. And you've also written a great piece that I recommend to readers, Misinformation is Here to Stay. And so what I get from you then is that you accept that bad journalism and misinformation are necessary evils, that if we're going to have a free society, we just have to tolerate those things. So this question is related to the one I asked previously, but what are some steps then that we can take to, or are there any steps that we can take to make sure this stuff doesn't proliferate? I mean, what is the answer to all this misinformation, particularly on the part of individual citizens, given that there is little to nothing that government can do that wouldn't violate important liberties?
Let me just first set the table by kind of putting sharpening the point a little bit, which is just that the conversation that we're experiencing now and witnessing now about the proliferation of misinformation on social media and on the internet is a conversation that we've had over and over again throughout the history of language evolving. I mean, there was a time when the printing press was a great threat to the world powers because the idea that we could print multiple copies of the same piece of information 100 times and then pass it out in a village somewhere was really scary. And the radio was the same thing. You know, everybody freaked out about the implications of information being able to move this fast into this many people. So this is not a new thing. It's not a new fear that we have. And certainly nobody today, I think, looks back and thinks the printing press or the radio were really bad ideas. I mean, I think, you know, spreading knowledge and people being able to read the same information all over the world is actually a really positive thing. But it's also true that with the power of, you know, the internet, the power to transmit information this quickly and at this scale, there are a lot of dangers that come with that. So I don't think the government should be involved in any kind of solution. I think the lowest hanging fruit is that the people who are in the quote unquote positions of power, you know, media institutions, people who are experts in their field, they need to be really careful about the kinds of mistakes that they make. They need to be really careful about making sure that the work they put out is the best work possible, because every time they make a colossal mistake or every time they, you know, get out over their skis on trying to declare what truth is and what is accurate and what is misinformation, what's a conspiracy, what's not, and they miss on those, it just erodes the trust that we have in those institutions. And I'm a very strong believer that we challenge bad ideas with good ones. You know, I know that to a lot of people, they hear that and it makes them cringe a little bit. Like, this is just a talking point that doesn't have a lot of substance, but it's really genuinely true. I mean, you see it over and over again. Even the kind of cancellations or deplatformings that we think have been successful, somebody like Alex Jones, those who follow him and love his work and want to tune into a show or InfoWars or whatever, they do it on platforms that are outside the mainstream where there's no dissent, where there are no people in the comments section saying, this is BS. That is not a healthy way to handle it. And putting stuff under the rug, in my experience, has never had the kind of long-term benefits the people who sort of support, you know, deplatforming or you know, removing misinformation and disinformation think it does. And I, again, think that it's here to stay. No matter what we do, misinformation and disinformation is going to proliferate. And we have to teach people, you know, how to address it, how to think about it, how to think critically. What we can't do is assign government power to decide what information is accurate or what should be allowed, or even, you know, independent groups. I mean, there's danger in that too. You see private companies like Facebook and Twitter trying to do this, and they make really bad mistakes all the time. So those tools can be helpful and maybe part of the equation, but I don't think any final arbiters of what's disinformation and what's not is really what we want to do.
I'm just curious if doing this work has changed you in any way. And if so, how has it changed you?
Yes, I think it's changed me profoundly, to be honest with you. I mean, I am asked a lot, you know, how is it that you are able to take certain approaches to the news where you openly change your mind about issues, or you are willing to come out and say you were wrong about something, or one day you're super aligned with Republicans and the next day you're really aligned with Democrats? And my answer is that I wasn't always like that. And I was just as ideological and in my own bubble as other people. But the practice of doing this work every day has made me realize how much more complicated the world is than I used to think it was. And it's a muscle that you train, you know, just like anything else. So I've gotten a lot better at being able to go into a story, seeing a headline, and immediately recognizing what was my just emotional, instinctual response to that story and trying to check it at the door and then read the whole thing and go look for some other opinions that might challenge me. And just being open-minded and comfortable with the fact that, you know, my preconceived notions might be wrong, my opinion might be ripe for an update. That kind of stuff, I think, for a lot of people is really scary. And it used to be scary for me, But over time, it's become much more exhilarating and exciting and intellectually stimulating to just go into something thinking, you know, I don't know what the answer is, and I'm not 100% sure where I'm going to land on this. And I wish more people did it and, you know, experience what I experienced, which I think is a really stimulating, interesting world out there that's not black and white and often exists in the gray. And it's taught me to listen a lot more than I speak, and it's taught me to have a much more open mind. And I've grown a lot more empathetic towards people of all different political persuasions, and just, you know, better understanding how they got there and why they're there.
Isaac, I appreciate you very much, not only for this conversation today, but for the work you're putting out there in the world.
Thank you so much for having me, Carolyn. I appreciate it.
Blair Thomas Hess and Cameron Ludwig certainly have done their homework on Kentucky and have the books to show for it. They co-authored The State of Bourbon, Exploring the Spirit of Kentucky, Presidents, Battles, and Must-See Civil War Destinations, Exploring a Kentucky Divided, Famous Kentucky Flavors, Exploring the Commonwealth's Greatest Cuisines, and My Old Kentucky Road Trip, Historic Destinations and Natural Wonders. And now there's a new one, Kentucky Y'all, a celebration of the people and culture of the Bluegrass State. And they're joining us now via Zoom. Blair and Cameron, welcome to Eastern Standard, y'all.
Thanks so much.
And so first things first, where are you from?
I think we're both from Lexington. I grew up in Lexington, and I have family from all over the state. My family's from Western Kentucky and then some from Maysville and Flemingsburg area.
Yes, and my family is mostly from the Louisville and Elizabethtown area. I know there's still a few Ludwigs near E-Town, where I believe the old family homestead is.
So the new book, does it draw from the research that went into your previous books about Kentucky?
It absolutely does. We both of us have been lifelong fans of being tourists in our own home. And Kentucky is an incredible state to be a tourist in, whether you live here or not. So in all of our travels for the previous books, we really have picked up these wonderful stories, these wonderful connections with folks from all across the state. And so pulling from those experiences, that research for the new book has been really, really invaluable.
Well, this book goes beyond the usual fare that we see in a book about Kentucky places, bourbon, fried chicken, the Derby, Kentucky basketball. And you get into some of Kentucky's oddities, as you put it, cultural quirks, traditions, rites of passage. And it's those areas that we would like to learn about in this conversation. And I'd like to start with part one, chapter one, curious culinary pairings. And I can think of a few, but tell us what you found.
Well, I think food is one of our favorite things to talk about. I know when I speak with Kentuckians and we start to talk about all the foods kind of invented in Kentucky, a lot of folks don't realize that it's more than just bourbon and fried chicken. So I think beer cheese and burgoo are among our favorites to talk about. Another favorite of ours is the fact that when you start to talk about things invented in Kentucky, you get a lot of arguments, right? We can talk about beer cheese originated in Winchester, and you get people that say, oh no, I think it was a German dish. And so we get to have these conversations about the lore of the original, the origins of everything, which I think is a lot of fun. And burgoo, of course, is a wonderful Kentucky tradition because it comes from necessity. It comes from kind of cooking with what you have around, whether that's game and whatever vegetables growing in the garden that year. And it's become this wonderful tradition where now we go out and we actually on purpose order it and not just, you know, out of need.
My other, you know, favorite story about food that really talks about necessity is the hot brown, which really was about what do you have in the kitchen in a hotel when everything's been closed down for the night, but everybody has come back from having an amazing party, night out, everyone's hungry. And so the chef at the Brown Hotel at the time just had to go into the kitchen, figure out what was there, what was going to satisfy some, shall we say, rowdy folks in from a night out. And here we have now this this Kentucky favorite that's been around for decades and generations that we still love.
Well, I wonder if one of you can solve a mystery for me, and that is the beaten biscuit. How did that happen? Is that a Kentucky thing?
It is, or at least I will say that my family from Elizabethtown, and beaten biscuits were a staple of Christmas at my grandparents' house in Louisville every year. And I'm sitting here crossing my fingers because I'm really hopeful that my grandmother passes down her beaten biscuit machine. I don't know that I can speak to the origins fully. I'm going to have to do some more research on that. But I do know her recipe calls for a minimum of 100 beats and turns of the dough. So you either have a machine or you have some really good biceps.
I think I want the machine, not the biceps.
Yes.
And if I remember correctly from my grandmother's house, it also paired well with country ham.
Oh, so good.
Yes. And if you have never been to the Trigg County Country Ham Festival, you can get the world's largest country ham and biscuit, which is a country ham served on a beaten biscuit. Oh. Only forklift size.
Yes. It is so impressive to see.
Well, let's jump down to chapter 13, where you go into a subject of sensitivity for many of us Kentuckians, especially those of us who've gone away for a time and have experienced places like New York or Washington or wherever. The chapter is titled The Accent. Just what are you all trying to say? question I've been asked a few times. Tell us what you've found about the various dialects that can be found across this state.
It's really interesting when we talk about, you know, the Kentucky accent, because it's something that for years Kentucky has struggled with. Are we Midwestern? Are we Southern? I think it depends on who you ask and what time of year and what the occasion is. And the accent is really also true to that. You know, if you go to the eastern part of the state in the Appalachian Mountains, you get this accent that is very much rooted in Elizabethan English. I mean, you will have so many ties to Shakespeare and some of this language that you just would not imagine sayings and phrases and accents to come from England and not be in Appalachia. Then you get to the central part of the state and, you know, it's a little bit more neutral. I think that has a lot to do with people coming and moving into this area, people from other states and the larger cities drawing sort of that diversity. And then Western, it's even different. And it's not so simple just to divide Kentucky into threes and say we're East, Central, and West, so that the accent is super unique. And it's not just the way we say things, it's how we communicate, the phrases that we use, turns of phrases that Cameron and I grew up hearing and just assuming everyone knew what they meant. And, you know, as it turns out, that's not something as common as maybe she and I thought that they were.
Things like once in a blue moon, for example.
Things like once in a blue moon. Things like rode hard and put up wet. You know, mm-hmm. That's what my mother used to say all the time. And I don't think a lot of people realize that's a tie to the horse industry. You know, if you don't thoroughly brush and clean your horse after riding it, before you put it into the stable for the night, it can get really, really agitated and very ruffly looking and so that's something that originates from that. There's just so many that are so fun. And I think the enjoyment for us was tracing a lot of those stories and where those origins come from and hearing everyone's different version of that.
We talk often on this program about Kentucky's famous writers and musicians, and you do that as well in the book, but you also shine a light on Kentucky's intellectual life, and you talk about famous minds with famous ideas. Give us more on that.
Oh, gosh, yes. You know, certainly growing up in and around Lexington, the Hunt Morgan House was one of the big spots for, I would say, school tours, for walking around the Gratz Park area downtown. And not only is that a famous family home for John Hunt Morgan, the Civil War Confederate general, but also a later descendant who was our first Nobel Prize winner in Kentucky for genetics. My other favorite fun fact is we've had two Nobel Prize winners from Kentucky, and both of them won for genetics.
I think it's also really fun just that I don't want to say that Kentucky doesn't have a reputation for being well-educated, but I think we all know there is something to be said for things that have always been said about Kentucky. You know, do we have all of our teeth and do we own shoes? And some of those stereotypes are really at the heart of what Cameron and I are trying to combat with this book. Is it's, you know, the book is organized in a way that we want to tell you fun things to teach you history. And we kind of build up to this end where we want to celebrate our fellow Kentuckians and just how wonderful they were. There are so many inventors from Kentucky. Garrett Morgan's from Paris. He invented the gas mask and a stoplight. I like to say the cheeseburger was invented here, and that was fun. But at the same time, the man, John Bibb, who cultivated Bibb lettuce, is also from Kentucky. There are all these really great minds that I think we don't talk about enough. And that's part of what we really wanted to do with the story.
You know, and I love the story of Thomas Hunt Morgan and his Nobel Prize really informing the work of Philip A. Sharp, who won a Nobel Prize in 1993, working at Kentucky universities where they got their undergraduate degrees. So it's really wonderful that we have two Nobel Prize winners from Kentucky. And I would say on education as a note, Madeleine McDowell Breckinridge was one of the largest proponents of progressive education early in our nation's history. So it's great to think that we really have made a mark in all of these areas, literature, music, thought, education, inventions that have carried on throughout the course of history.
Well, I mentioned earlier that you look at all kinds of oddities and cultural quirks here in the Commonwealth. What did you find that we might not know about?
Oh, gosh. That's a big question.
You know, we started as road trip authors, you know, so this started years and years ago when Cameron and I set out to go to Mammoth Cave together. And we decided that we would take a road trip to Mammoth Cave. And of course, in the process of traveling to Mammoth Cave, we made a weekend of it. We slept at Wigwam Village number 2 in Cave City, which are concrete wigwams assembled in a semicircle, and you could spend the night there. They have beds and showers. But when we were there, you know, we met people who were road tripping across the country, and they had chosen Wigwam Village number 2 to spend the night. On our way to Mammoth Cave, we saw an old country store that sold moccasins and
antique farm implements.
And antiques and all these things. And we stopped and it made us late for our Mammoth Cave tour. So it's one of those things that we kind of have stumbled upon these things along the way. And that's part of the fun is everywhere we go, someone will say, well, have you also been here? We've come across, there's a Stonehenge in Munfordville where someone, it's on private property, but they welcome visitors. And it's a husband and wife who built this Stonehenge replica in honor of their daughter who passed away, and you can come and walk around. There's just all of these great things that aren't necessarily when you look up Kentucky, either on the internet or in a guidebook, and you say, okay, I'm going to hit the top destinations like Cumberland Falls and Mammoth Cave. There's all these other things along the way that you just discover by happenstance, which is the best part.
I think one of my favorite oddities, and I'm going to speak for both of us here, we tend to love the really wild festivals that happen in small towns and small counties. I think my personal favorite to tell folks about, honestly, folks in Kentucky don't know about this festival as well as folks from outside, is the Banana Festival in Fulton. I'm certainly the history nerd of the two of us. And the idea that this banana festival that grew in an inland state still exists in Kentucky every year, I just love it. And it really grew from transporting bananas from the port of New Orleans all the way up through the Midwest and up the Mississippi River. Well, the boats would have to stop at a midway point and re-ice all of the fruit that they were carrying. And Fulton, Kentucky, right on the Mississippi River, was where they decided to stop. So they had huge warehouses for keeping the bananas fresh while they re-iced the boats. And there's a whole host of really great festivals across the state that I know both of us love going to.
Well, let me ask each of you before we close, one really fun fact that sticks with you from this project.
Previous to this book, I did not know about the Churchill Weavers. The Churchill Weavers are from a story that originates in Berea. They have nothing to do with Churchill Downs. They were a husband and wife weaving pair, not native Kentuckians, but after mission work in Africa, they settled in Kentucky near Berea, and they were actually tasked with weaving a spacesuit for a space mission to make sure that it would survive in zero gravity and space conditions. It wasn't finally selected for that space mission, but it did make it through all of NASA's checks. And it was this husband and wife weaver pair who now you can still get a lot of their products I found some on eBay. There are some blankets and things available on eBay still, but their weaving operation in Berea has been shut down for several years.
It is beautiful work though. For sure.
It really is. And I would highly recommend looking through the archives at the Kentucky History Center as well.
They have all of those textiles available. It's a really neat collection.
I would say my favorite fun fact that I learned that I didn't know about was about the salute to Black jockeys that took place in Louisville for more than a decade at Shirley May's Cafe and Bar. Shirley May Beard had this great restaurant in Smoketown in Louisville. And as a counterpoint to the annual Derby Festival, she really wanted to make sure that they were honoring the Black jockeys who really created the horse racing industry early on. I think it was something like 13 of the first 15 Derby winners were Black jockeys. So it's a pretty incredible thing that really she and her daughters kind of rediscovered these Black jockeys in old archives. And it was their festival in Louisville, their celebration Salute to Black Jockeys, that helped bring that history back to the forefront and made sure that those early jockeys like Isaac Burns Murphy and Oliver Lewis had their place in history once again.
Well, I think we could talk about this till the cows come in. Is that a Kentuckianism, too? I'm not sure.
We'll claim that one, too. We claim all.
We'll claim it.
Blair Thomas Hess, Cameron Ludwig, authors of Kentucky Y'all, A Celebration of the People and Culture of the Bluegrass State, published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks.
With her debut album, Out of These Hills, Eastern Kentucky artist Taylor Austin Dye racked up more than 39 million streams across all of the platforms, 750,000 followers on TikTok, 370,000 on Facebook, 160,000 on Instagram. And now she's out with a new album, heading out on tour and making her first appearance on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry. And she's here to talk to us about it all. Thanks for joining us, Taylor.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with where you grew up, Boonville in Owsley County. Was there a lot of music going on around you as you grew up?
You know, there was not a lot going on around us at all. You know, yeah, I'm sure you do. But there was a lot of talent, man. There was a lot of people that were just super talented. And I grew up just learning from everybody around me. I learned to play by ear. And, you know, some of those people are more talented than the people you hear on the radio. And they're farmers, they're mechanics, they're just your regular everyday people. And I just think Eastern Kentucky has such a rich pool of talent.
Well, I want to ask you something that kind of comes from a personal experience. One of my sons had this happen when he just decided at one point early in life, music is it, Dad. This is what I'm going to do for a living. When did that happen to you? Do you recall, you know, kind of what that was like?
Honestly, completely truthful, when I was 5 years old, I was playing on the barn dance at Renfro Valley every weekend. I was in the young country part of it, and I would sing, play the fiddle, and clog. And I would do that every weekend. And I just loved being on stage. It just was something that was so natural for me. I would never get like stage fright or anything. It always just felt like that's where I wanted to be. So ever since then, I knew that I really had no other choice. I just had to chase it.
Well, it's not always a smooth road to where you are now. I'm just wondering what kind of obstacles or challenges you encountered on the way to this new album.
Well, I mean, music, just like anything else, it's tough. I mean, I'm so thankful for what I do, and I wouldn't have it any other way. But getting to where I am now, you know, a lot of people are just now finding me and hearing my music, but I've truthfully been grinding ever since I was five. I would play, you know, when I was growing up, any fair or festival, any bar that would let me in before I was even 21 to sing on stage, you know. And I moved down to Nashville about 6 years ago, and I just started playing on Broadway. I didn't have any friends, didn't have any connections of any kind. And I just kind of, I did that as my full-time job. And if I didn't make the tips, I wasn't going to pay the rent. So it molded me into a better entertainer, you know, because if you're not interacting with the audience and working for those tips, you know, you're not paying the rent. So I think that helped me, you know, in the long run. It was definitely an obstacle at the time, but now it's taught me to be such a better entertainer.
So this is your sophomore album, Sick of Me. It was recently released. It's described in the information as a powerful project about self-deprecation, reflection, and the desire for change. What's that about? What's the message in your music?
So the title track, we chose Sick of Me to be the title track because, you know, there's just been times in my life where I have just been literally sick of myself. I feel like I've been a total screw up. I've messed up. And I think everyone goes through that. And it's not really something you hear about a lot, especially in the country music space of women. And I know a lot of us go through it. So just being able to bring that kind of powerful, you know, thing of saying, you know, I've messed up. I am, you know, I'm sick of myself, but I'm wanting to change and I want to be better. And the whole album kind of tells that story of, you know, trying to make those changes and be the person that you want to be.
The song Hurt My Feelings, listen to it. It's really moving, and it's a deep dive into your emotions around past trauma, life experiences. Can you take us into that song a little bit? Can you talk about those emotions?
Yeah, so this song kind of came out of left field because I had a write with two writers that I had never even met before. And we got in the room, and I'm an open book. You know, I write what I know. And we just start delving into each other's lives. And it's no secret that my father and I had a horrible relationship, especially at the end. And I've had failed relationships, and that's no secret. I'm very open about all that stuff. So we started talking about that. And then one of my other co-writers, Brooke, she started talking about how she had had relationship struggles as well. And we just kind of intertwined those stories to talk about like your emotions and how I'm not really an emotional person in general, but, you know, sometimes you're so overwhelmed with emotion. In my case, I just wish that I didn't have any feelings. I didn't have any emotion. So the idea of kind of hurting your own feelings, like sadness and shame and pain, you just wish you could get rid of them. And that's kind of where the idea from that song came from.
My dad made me think that every boy I meet is going to wind up running round and run right out on me. And every problem's answer is a pill and whiskey neat. I hate that he did that to me. And that boy I ended up with, cause they all told me to, couldn't hold down a job, and he turned me right into the man of the house, drained every last ounce of my dignity. I really hate that he did that to me. Wish I could rip this weight right off my chest, drown this weakness, catch my
You're heading out on a nationwide tour to promote the album. You must be pretty excited about that, I imagine.
Oh, we've already had a few shows. We've had the best time. You know, we've been in Kentucky, Georgia, Tennessee, Ohio. We're heading all over the place. And then this tour is going to continue into next year as well. So we're really excited to hit the road in some new places we've never been.
Now, you signed a publishing deal.
I did.
That had to be quite an exciting moment. What were you thinking when you landed that? And that was with Warner, is that correct?
Yeah. I actually wasn't even seeking out a publishing deal. I've always, you know, owned my own music. I write a lot by myself, to be honest. So it was never really something that I was desperately seeking out. But when the opportunity came to take a meeting with them, I was ecstatic because the team over there is just fantastic.
Well, for listeners who might not quite understand what that means when you've signed with a label like that, maybe expand on that a little bit.
So basically, if you're a songwriter, you write songs, you put them out. Even if you don't put them out, you let somebody else put them out. You get paid for it, in essence. You know, I was writing songs just for myself and to put out into the world, but now I'm getting paid to do what I was already doing, what I already love to do. And, you know, even if I don't cut some of these songs, you may hear other artists cutting my songs now, which I'm obviously open and totally excited for.
Well, what advice can you offer to others who are kind of behind you on their path to breaking out? What would you look back and tell them to think about?
Well, the best advice I ever got was actually from my uncle. And when I first moved to town, he was always really on me about, you know, not losing my accent, not forgetting where I came from, like just really being myself and the unforgiving version of yourself, no matter what other people think. And he said, nobody wants to go to Walmart and buy the edited version of an Eminem CD. You know, you want the full on explicit version, and not even with curse words or anything like that. But, you know, the fact that I dig really deep in my songs and talk about things like domestic violence and prostitution and all those things, like, I think it's just really important to remember who you are, where you came from, write about what you know, and just truly be as authentic as you can without losing yourself.
Well, hats off to your uncle.
Smart man.
Taylor Austin Dye, good luck, and thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We hope you'll join us next week when we celebrate in a very special way the bicentennial of the founding of Pikeville, Kentucky. We'll have a radio monologue, Fiddlesticks and Dynamite, with Appalachian Center for the Arts Education and Outreach Director Crockett Ward in the role of Dr. William Hambly, who served as mayor of Pikeville for 29 years and was a powerful force of change for the city. Here's a passage.
You see, I was mayor here for a good long time. Long enough to change the way things were to the way they are now. As a child of only 4, I had a vision that stayed with me long afterwards. I had typhoid fever, was in a coma, and in my illness, an enormous sphere of brilliant white light, a clear crystal ball, hovered above as if wanting to engulf me. My mother fought that orb for hours, and eventually the light went away. I recovered, but it was a slow recovery. Still, that moment, and I can't say why, gave me a sense of purpose, that I had a mission to help my hometown. Now, I didn't know what I should do or how, but throughout my childhood, I watched, I listened, and I learned.
And it's what Mayor Hambly learned that turned out to be life-altering for the people of Pikeville. Hint, it involves an earth-moving project second only to the Panama Canal. Also next week, a fascinating conversation with Misty Wrigley Miller, the force behind the new Lex Studio, the big film and television production house in Lexington. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. And remember, good judgment comes from experience, and a lot of that comes from bad judgment. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.